This is exactly right.
Hello. We want to take a second to tell you about one of our favorite podcasts, Disgraceland. If you like music, pop culture, and true crime, this is the podcast for you.
Through host Jake Brennan's deeply researched storytelling, you'll hear all about the lives and crimes of musicians like Jerry Lee Lewis, Jay-Z, the Rolling Stones, and so many more.
And now Disgraceland is expanding to include artists, actors, athletes, and other icons from Anthony Bourdain to Andy Warhol.
Full episodes are released every Tuesday. Check out Disgraceland on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.
Goodbye.
Hello.
Hi.
And welcome
to
my
favorite
Immurderer,
the podcast
that tells you
just things,
fucking tons of random terrible things,
right, without curse words.
That's right. This is an all Christian podcast.
A child friendly,
religious based.
We've got fucking railroad, or what are they called, trains going by in the background constantly.
Ghost trains. We don't believe in evolution. Everything you could want in a podcast. Wow, that train's loud.
Yeah. Do you know, I got into an Uber the other day and like there was this rock music playing and I was like, okay, rock music, great. And then it was like the lyrics were like, oh fuck, you're trying to sell me hard on Jesus H. Christ.
And you were like, Hava Nagila. I've had that a couple times in Ubers where I feel like people are like, they're trying to work, they're trying to make a dollar, but they're also like, well, I could kill two birds with one stone and be spreading the word of our Lord.
I wonder if there's like a cult of, you know, Jesus people who are like, this is how we're going to get people on, is we're going to Uber and play pretty good rock music.
Pretty good, passable.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I did Dave Holmes Friday 40 last Friday.
Love it.
Chris Fairbanks of Do You Need a Ride? And he said, I can't remember how it came up, but he goes, have you ever had that thing where you start to hear a song, you really like it, and then you realize it's Christian, and then you realize you're like a hypocrite
That's
for not liking it?
Kind of what happened. Well, yeah. I don't want to hear about how he lifts you up and you raise your paws in the
Georgia.
Air.
He lifts you.
Like Dirty Dancing style, like Patrick Swayze.
No one puts Jesus in a corner.
Boom. End the podcast.
Boom. Goodbye.
Lights out.
Fuck all y'all. Hey, can I read this? Because fine, I've been exposed as being obsessed with bowling. Fine, I don't care anymore.
Why haven't we bowled yet?
I know, we've had at least 2 days. So someone sent us a picture of the bowling socks I was talking about last on the Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
The Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Exactly as I described, 3 bowling pins, a red bowling ball, and what looks like puffs of air at the bottom. Do you think that's the speed of the ball hitting those?
Because it's almost like a bomb goes off when
it
hit,
you know? On your ankles.
Yeah.
And they're, these ones, it says, this is for Hardstark. That's you, Georgia.
Thank you.
Oh, because this is Instagram.
Okay.
Stephen Ray Morris, my favorite murder. I believe I got them at Mission Bowling Club. Is that in San Francisco? It is. Gray Wing. This is from Gray Wing on Instagram, San Francisco. P.S. My grandmother is in the Bowling Hall of Fame.
Ugh.
What?
I'm so proud of your grandma.
Who is she? Please send us
What's
more
her
information.
Instagram? Oh, yeah.
Gray Wing. GREYWING, San Francisco, California. If you could please send us a very concise book report, 3 to 5 paragraphs about your grandmother.
With photographs from when she was playing bowling and as an elderly woman.
What if it's both?
Oh my God.
What if she started young and went all the way into modern day?
I want to know what she carried in her purse on a regular basis.
Hall of Fame, though. She's not just a great bowler. She is of the greatest bowlers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know San Francisco. I mean, that's where my people are from.
Yeah.
That's why I'm so passionate about bowling.
It's not like they have a shortage of good bowlers. So that means she was really fucking good.
That's right. It's what everyone's like up there. It matters.
We're gonna go bowling soon. Oh, today's Valentine's Day.
Oh yeah, happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Thank you. Well, yesterday was Valentine's Day based on the when this podcast is going out.
Based on the reality you people live in.
Right.
Not the one that we truly are stuck in.
We're currently drinking coffee and whiskey in.
That's right. We're having such a Valentine's Day party. Steven's drinking coffee out of a cat mug, which is his lifelong dream, right? I'm drinking a coffee out of an FBI mug. No, sorry, LA County Coroner mug, which is my dream. George is having some nice whiskey on ice.
Out of a vintage fucking tumbler mug, tumbler glass.
Yeah, it looks like something that would absolutely have been left on my grandmother's nightstand.
Definitely.
And then in the background, there is a train that has not, there hasn't been a train that's come by here in 25 years.
We're living our lives. I wanted to tell you that after a 20-year hiatus, I am again reading Stranger Beside Me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What brought you back to us? Zac Efron?
Well, people want to hear, people want us to talk about that.
We have talked about it.
I know, but they want us to, there's more photos now.
Okay.
And I, and as, and now that I'm reading it and like in it, I see the photos and I'm like, I know when that was like supposed to have happened. And
God. Yeah, when did Ted Bundy go through a weightlifting phase? That's the question I have. Because the first photo
saw. You think he's too cut?
He's insanely cut. For, from what I, in my limited, as we all know, extremely limited research, he, Ted Bundy always seemed like kind of a skinny little professorial type.
I think it's like a skinny, but like, what are the, you know, like a tennis player.
Sinewy?
Sinewy.
He's a sinewy.
This is
type.
Why you wanted Gary.
Sinise?
Sinise. Maybe we just happen to.
Is it Sinise, or are you just saying that because of Sinise?
I think it is. There's someone you said you wanted to play him before this whole Efron thing came out.
It was not Gary Sinise.
Who was it?
Yep.
Steven.
Come on, Steven. What? You can't put your hands up like you don't work here. You son of a bitch. Steven.
Steven, you had one job.
You
to
have
remember
one job,
Karen.
Which is to memorize every word I say.
It's not Gary Sinise.
No.
It's
Gary Sinise.
It's, oh God, what's
it's
his
someone,
name?
He it's looks someone who like looks like that.
Ted Bundy. Who would you want to play? Let's start over. Who do you think should play Ted Bundy? Not Zac Efron.
Let me stroke my minorly invisible beard.
It's. Forget it. Edit this out.
No, this is
no.
The one,
Steven's saying
is,
no.
This is Steven's. Like you don't decide.
He
I
looks
decide.
Like Bill Pullman.
Okay. I remember this, and I remember when it hit me. I was like, I'm a fucking casting genius.
You were, and he's in the movie.
Not Chris Pine.
Is he? No.
Okay.
Is, I love him. Is he in the movie with Jack Nicholson when Jack Nicholson has...
Greg Kinnear!
Greg Kinnear!
There are people who have been screaming at their podcast machines this whole time.
Gary and Greg. So similar.
You were right there with that G.
I mean, with the four letter word and the G.
Greg Kinnear is the with dark hair because his eyes are little. He's good looking classically, but his eyes are just enough close together that you are suspicious of his agenda. Is this train circling the apartment?
I think the train is coming for us.
Can you hear it, Steven? Okay, good.
It's we're tied on the track right now. It's
we
the
haven't
1920s.
Paid our, we haven't paid our rent.
Steven is twirling his mustache as he watches us tied to the track.
Oh, good. Buster Keaton's here.
Oh, great. I, you know, I'm having, now, of course, I'm having Ted Bundy nightmares.
Okay. And because you're in that book.
And I keep saying, stop reading this, Georgia. Stop reading this, Georgia. And I can't put it down.
It's so good.
It's so good. And it's also so dated. And Anne Rule, like, she should never have died because she just needs to keep updating this book.
It's the idea, like, when she tells that story, the idea that she was this single mother who was trying, who was working for the police department, but was also trying to be a freelance writer.
And she's like, what are the fucking chances?
What are the chances? And she's, but she's also volunteering at night. Like, what what a badass. And then she volunteers next to pretty much one, second only to like Ed Gein or Dahmer, like
not
one of the
I
most.
Think maybe Dahmer.
Gacy. But one of the, like, yeah, no.
I think everyone, I think Ted Bundy was relatable to everyone because he was hot.
Yes, he was so tricky. He was the ultimate, like, wolf in sheep's clothing.
Totally.
He was, he's,
well, she didn't
small.
Even believe that he could have done it for so many.
She didn't believe it when it was like, it's, we've found a man in a gold Volkswagen Bug.
She called her friends at the detective agency and was like, just look into my friend. I know this is weird.
Yes.
Like, she even turned him in and she was like, I don't, it can't be.
It can't be him, but could you look? Because she was like, I can't deny these stacking up facts.
Right.
But still, it's not him. I know it's not him.
And I'll,
That's the classic sociopath, like, or psychopath.
Well, we didn't know it at the, well, we, I wasn't boring. they didn't know it at the time that was a thing, that even though someone doesn't look like a fucking murderer.
Or act like it. No one, those people don't act like murderers.
Yeah. Oh. Well, now we know what. Well, so the movie is coming out. With Zac Efron. I hope he kills it. I'm looking forward to it.
I think he will.
I think he looks like him enough. And the other thing that she keeps talking about is that he was like a shapeshifter, that he looked different all the fucking time, which is why it was so hard to pin down, is that he kind of always changed his look.
That's right. In fact, you can, if you look it up online, and I'm sure everyone that's, most of the people listening have already seen this, but there is a collage of his mugshots, and you can see how the way they couldn't, like when he went from Seattle to Utah.
And it's not even like a beard or not a beard. It's just this look in his face that's so different. And that's the spookiest part.
Yeah. And then by the time he gets to Florida, he's just a fucking maniac.
Good for Zac Efron, man. What a fucking role.
Yeah, I think he can do it.
Oh, what a dream. Fucking role. Well, so there's this documentary.
He just can't, can I just say this?
Yeah.
He can't, I hope he knows, and if they're still shooting and he can hear me, don't smile with your eyes. Because that's it. You got to go dead zone.
Totally.
With those crazy eyes.
Totally.
Because Zac Efron's a big, like, he's like one of, the reason he's like a Disney star is because he's one of those 12-year-old boys that would wink at a grown woman.
Ew.
It's a specific
he's
type
a Bieber.
Of, he's a Ryan,
Macbeth.
Let's do this again.
Oh my God. He's a Ryan.
Let's do it some more. Who's the one everyone loves?
I don't like him. Steven?
Ryan Seacrest?
No!
Are you fucking kidding me, Steven?
He's the one. You know, the blonde one who was in Drive. Drive, right?
Oh, yeah. Ryan Gosling.
Thank you.
He's a Gosling.
You were almost fired.
Ugh.
He's a Gosling.
Seacrest. God damn it.
Steven out. Of a job.
That's how you fire Steven. What if that's how Ryan Seacrest fires people? Joanne out of accounting.
Oh, Joanne.
Joanne out.
She did her best.
She tried, but...
Okay, so there's a documentary that's been being made of Ted Bundy that I really want to come out before... You know, it's the thing of like, you know, I haven't watched I, Tonya yet, but I made sure to watch the 30 for 30 about Tonya Harding before I watched... Eventually,
the Hollywood version,
exactly, because you want to see what really happened. So there's this documentary that this woman, Celine Beth Calderon, probably, she's been trying to make, called Theodore, the documentary, and she's trying to raise funds on Indiegogo. She's the first female filmmaker to make a documentary about Ted Bundy, which I think we both know is huge because she's focusing on the victims and not Ted Bundy being this like. Marilyn Manson type. Also, they're
always wore that one blue contact.
They're doing an Indiegogo thing, but they're even with that, they're giving 5% of what they make to Rain.
Oh, so that's like, amazing.
She's not. I mean, I just really hope it comes out before.
So, what's her name again?
So her name is Celine Calderon, and it's Theodore, the documentary. And she keeps, I follow her on Instagram, she keeps posting, like, there's a photo of fucking Ted Bundy, like, never seen before, next to the fucking bug.
Ugh.
And then she got, like, she's interviewed a fucking shit ton of people who were involved, who have never spoken before about it, and she needs money to interview more people so she can make the documentary. I really want it to be made.
Such a passion project.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing. If you're up there and on your high hill in your mansion and you want to throw some dollar bills a certain way,
right,
that would be amazing.
Indiegogo, and then you just look up Theodore, the documentary, and I just think it should come out beforehand,
and then give the equal amount to Rain also,
right?
Yeah, get it all done in one donation.
Don't be a dick.
Come on, stop being so greedy.
You
on your
know
hill.
How mean you are.
Why are you up on that hill in the
Ryan
fucking first
Seacrest
place?
You owe it to everyone to make this documentary happen.
Ryan, we know that you have 9 jobs, which means that you could donate, what, 50 grand and get fucking thing made?
50 grand is nothing
for
him. Come on.
You're natural. You're America loves you. Love us back.
Yeah.
Is that too strong?
No.
For Valentine's Day.
It's Valentine's Day.
Ryan Seacrest, you're my Valentine.
Love is in the air and whatnot. Someone Knows Something, season 4 started.
Ah.
Loving it. David Riggin.
I love something. Someone Knows Something.
He's so good. This new one is about...
I love something, something, something.
This new one is about this dude who gets sent this bomb, explodes in his fucking hands, dies, still hasn't been solved. It was like 1996.
What?
And goes back to fucking figure out what happened. It's super good already. And I'm really angry because they didn't drop all the episodes at once.
Oh, they're so you have to wait. It,
which is so smart, but...
There's nothing worse than having to wait.
But I hate it.
That's great.
Yeah, it's good.
Does he crunch down any country lanes?
He fucking does his signature crunching towards the door from his car.
Beautiful.
He does. It's his thing. It's his signature.
I see him in my mind as I listen to him do that, and it's such a delightful and yet also incredibly upsetting movie.
Only he can get away with that.
Yeah,
because it's such a documentary filmmaker thing to do.
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
It's so exciting that there's another season.
I love it. That's all I have to say.
Hey, Karen, you know that feeling when you're stressed out and your heart starts to pound and your mind is racing?
I do. I know it well.
Well, while there's no cure for stress, therapy can help shape your response to it. And since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, there's no better time to try Talkspace.
When you sign up for Talkspace, you'll receive a personalized match with a therapist or psychologist, typically within 48 hours.
Forbes rates Talkspace as the number one online therapy platform, plus their licensed professionals are in-network with almost all major insurance companies.
Once you meet your therapy goals, or if you want to cancel for any reason, Talkspace will provide you with a prorated refund for unused time. I feel like these days people understand the importance of therapy, but the difficult part is just taking that first step. It took me months to make my first therapy appointment. I was so scared. I had a lot of ideas in my head about it. And that's why I think Talkspace is such a good idea, because making it so approachable will just get you there sooner. Then you can actually get in there, figure out what you need, talk to an actual professional, and be on your way to solving some stuff that you might want to solve.
To celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month and the power of talking it out in therapy, Talkspace is offering our listeners $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80.
Go to Talkspace.com/MFM and use promo code SPACE80.
To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/MFM and enter promo code SPACE80 and get $80 off your first month and show your support for our show.
That's Talkspace.com/MFM. Enter promo code SPACE80.
Goodbye.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com.
Goodbye. Okay, so this was a story that I wanted to do when we were in Columbus.
Okay.
But it's too awful.
Oh, good.
So I'm going to go back. I know that these days I've been doing lots of slightly off kilter, lighter, whatever types of stories. I've gone all the way back to the Ridge. This is a fucking awful, awful and recent murder.
And you can't tell them why you can't do it at live shows.
Well, in live shows, well, first of all, we have to have stuff that we can talk about and riff about and like, and connect over and kind of go like, wait, what did you just say or whatever? Yeah. And when it's a, especially if it's a recent murder, if children are involved, if it's unsolved, if it's, you know, just, if it's just relentless horror.
If it hits too close to home.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just don't want to, it's horrible.
Yeah. And also I think everyone together, I mean, we've had times where we've talked about really hard stuff, mm-hmm. but it can't just be that way the whole time. So, but when I was looking this up, I was like, I think it might be worth it because there's an element to this that is so fascinating. It transcends the horror of what happened.
Well, I think we should do whatever we want when it's you and I.
Yeah. Right.
And there's Stephen. but at live shows, it's hard to do really horrific murders.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like look up. I mean, there is an interesting element to like grieving with 2,000 people at a time, but
not when they're mad at you.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just hard. But so I can just tell you this and then, and
just
then
tell
people
me.
Can listen. I'm just going to tell
no
you.
No one else
it.
Is listening.
Stephen, please put those headphones on more. So this happened in Mount Vernon, Ohio last November.
Holy, like as in 4 months ago?
4 months ago.
November, December, January. Oh shit.
4 fucking months ago. Happy 2018, by the way. Oh, did we even say that?
It's Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day. And an upcoming President's Day. So on November 10th of last year, when Tina Herman didn't show up for work at Dairy Queen, her boss goes over to her house to check and see what's going on. And when he gets there, he finds it littered with beer cans and covered in blood. It was actually described as looking like a horror movie inside the house.
Oh, God.
So, of course, he immediately calls the police. Tina's not in the house. Her 13-year-old daughter's not in the house. Her 11-year-old son's not in the house. And her friend, whose car is in the driveway, is not in the house. Mm-mm. So immediately the police start a massive manhunt. There's people walking around on foot. It's in the air. Like the whole area goes crazy. The next night, Tina Herman's pickup truck is found near the Kenyon College campus. They actually, when they found the pickup truck, they did a lockdown on the school.
Wow.
Because they thought maybe the guy was nearby.
Oh, shit.
The police interview people that are walking around the area. They don't find anything suspicious. Back at Tina Herman's house, the police that are processing the scene find Walmart bags with a Walmart bag with a receipt inside. And the receipt shows purchasing of garbage bags and a large heavy-duty tarp.
Never good.
All the police are like, you know what? I remember this chapter in school. Bad fucking news. So they go to that Walmart that's on the receipt. They check their surveillance video at the time of the receipt. And on it, it clearly shows a very young brown-haired man, probably in his early 30s, buying these items at the store. Mm. And on the video, they can also see when he leaves, they see him drive by in his Yaris.
So. Yaris? I was not expecting that.
That's right. There are a lot of people drive Yarises proudly, and this guy was one of them. So it's all like right there on the tape.
Yeah.
So the cops go to the DMV, they search the records, they cross check whatever.
Yarises.
They go to all the Yaris owners.
Cross check Yaris.
They arrest all of them for bad taste. Mm. I'm joking. Oh my God. Onslaught of Yaris.
Everyone,
emails.
I know it's a good car.
How dare you? I bought this with my own money. Although I have to tell you, my friend Tisha and I bought my Honda Fit at the same time she bought her Yaris. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to decide between the two. And I was always like, you gotta go with this Honda Fit. Mm-hmm. And she was like, nope, I think I'm gonna go with the Yaris. And I was just like, I felt so like, it was like
smug.
UCLA versus USC.
Oh.
I was just like, goodbye.
Yeah.
We're not on the same team anymore.
Wow.
I haven't spoken to her since.
That's intense.
Just kidding.
Holy shit.
That's how deep this Yaris shit goes with me. Okay. So they find out through the DMV records and his driver's license, this man is Matthew Hoffman. He's a 30-year-old unemployed tree trimmer. Then once they see the pictures, one of the officers goes, I fucking talked to that guy up at the college when we found the truck.
Nuh-uh.
Yes.
Like one of the people he questioned?
Yep. He was right nearby.
What?
So they're like, call everybody. We're doing
the
thing.
Gather the troop.
Right.
You know, circle the wagons.
Circle the troops. Circle the wagons is what most cops say when they think they have a person.
Gather the wagons, circle the troops.
Gather our friends and let us go out together and fight crime.
Yes.
So they fucking send the SWAT team to this guy's house. And so this basically takes 4 days. So 4 days after the family's found missing, the cops kick his foot. I don't know how it happened.
Kick it.
The cops kick down the fucking door.
Yeah.
Matthew Hoffman is sleeping on the couch inside in the living room. And are you ready?
No, your face looks unhappy.
Well, it's not horrifying, but it's this. They find the entire living room is filled with leaves.
What?
Huge pile of leaves.
Leaves.
Piled so high that the police feared bodies might be buried underneath them.
What the fuck?
So many fucking leaves. Mount Vernon Police Detective Craig Feeney told the Columbus Dispatch, so much runs through your mind. What if somebody's hiding under that pile? Or in this case, I thought, what if that's where he's hiding the bodies?
What the fuck?
Leaves.
Leaves.
They walk down the hall to the bathroom.
No, don't do it.
You want to pull up these pictures? I brought pictures for you. This is how I found the story. And it stopped me so cold. I was just like, what in the fuck are we doing
here? Oh my God. Oh my God.
So this is the bathroom.
No.
I'm showing you the picture.
What?
The walls of the bathroom are lined with plastic shopping bags filled with leaves. And it looks insulated. Like when we'll
it looks
post
like
this
insulation, like before you put on the drywall, you put bags
of leaves.
Kmart. And thank you. And of like perfectly filled bags of leaves.
Perfectly spaced, perfectly hung, each one right up the same width, same depth of, you know, it's not like sloppy. Bags of leaves hung on the wall.
What the?
Piles of leaves on the ground.
How have I never heard of this?
Because it just happened, I think. Oh, and so that's, you saw
yeah.
them.
Yeah. So it's not even like, it's just leaves, legitimate. It's not dirt and it's not gravel. It's just leaves.
And isn't that something that's absolutely from like a David Fincher movie?
Yeah, because it's one of those things where it's like, it doesn't mean anything, but it's so creepy.
Yes.
As it is.
It just like the moths in Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
Where you're like, it's just moths. It's not
just
that big of a deal.
People collect insects, I guess.
I mean, you know, a bit. Yeah. Their touch.
Yeah.
But when that moth lands next to her, and just when she's like, may I use your phone, please? I always have to get one of those in there. Okay, so.
Love it.
Finally, they go down into the basement.
Don't do that.
There's a door closed and it's barricaded with this big sewing machine cabinet thing. When they break down the door, they get inside. They find Tina Herman's 13-year-old daughter alive. She's bound and gagged, and she's laying on a makeshift bed of leaves.
This dude loves leaves.
I mean, it's so and it's this dank, creepy basement. Ugh. Obviously, she's been raped. And she was wearing a plastic bag with holes cut it for legs like a diaper. So creepy.
Oh my God.
He's arrested, taken into custody.
How the fuck did I not see this?
I don't know.
Twitter's algorithms are really disappointing me.
I mean, I was so, like, this was one of those ones where I was just like, I don't know. I think it's worth, I think this is the kind of thing that people that are interested in true crime, when you hear a story where you're like, sorry, what are we doing? Like, what is this?
But like, I was in Columbus with you and I was like looking up Columbus murders to do for the show. And I didn't fucking see this.
Right.
Okay, go on.
I mean, I feel like it was breaking news.
Yeah.
Most of the articles that I found to tell you about this were, they were waiting for, like, basically once they found the girl, they still didn't know where the family was. And they still didn't know. They were like, we still have three people missing. Thank God she's well. And they, and just so you guys know, they did print her name when they first reported on the story.
Right.
Then when they realized she was a sexual assault victim, they stopped printing her name. So that's why I'm not saying her name.
Okay.
So they're questioning Matthew Hoffman. He's not saying anything. They said that this reporter that was writing this, so the, these stories are from the Columbus Dispatch and also from the Denver Post. But they say there's hours of footage of police trying to question him and him just not saying a word. And then finally, he tells the police that he wants to confess because he has a bad dream about being at a food processing plant.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So he tells police he opened up the, in the dream, he opened up a trash bag at the food processing plant and he saw cut up body parts and he got a knot in his stomach and it all, quote unquote, came back to him. And so finally he confesses to the murder of Tina Herman, her 11-year-old son, Cody, and her friend, Stephanie Sprang, whose car was in her driveway.
Oh, no.
He tells police that he waited in the woods across the street from Tina Herman's house the night before. He was up in a tree, leaves, unemployed tree trimmer. He's got a tree issue. He's up in a tree. He watches the house all night. At 9 a.m, he sees Tina Herman leave the house. So he thinks the house is empty and the garage door doesn't go down all the way.
Mm-mm.
So he sees his, this is his chance to slip in. He goes into the house. He's in, he told police.
Do we know how, or is this going to come up, like how he knew who they were? Or he just, it was just a random.
Well, he had already been arrested once before for burglarizing a house by slipping into an open garage door.
Okay.
So when he told police he actually had only gone in to burglarize the house, they believed that it was basically an interrupted burglary because he had done it once before and only burgled the house.
Okay.
And there's other extenuating circumstances in his life that are different on this one. But basically, Tina and her friend, Stephanie, came back to the house and interrupted him an hour after he broke in.
Mm-mm.
And so he stabbed them both to death.
Holy shit.
Yes. And then he's just dismembering their bodies and the kids come home from school. So he stabs the 11-year-old boy to death in the doorway. The 13-year-old daughter runs to her room. He grabs her. He ties her up with an electric fan cord and he puts her in his truck or in his, I can't, it's really weird because he did this thing where he had a Jeep. But then he also used Tina's truck.
Right.
And that's why he's the one that left it at the college.
Right.
And he had gone on foot back somewhere and he was walking back to drive the truck back to her house. And that's when the cops started talking to him. So he had this
whole... And he could play it cool. They didn't even suspect him.
Yes.
So something is fucking wrong with this dude.
That's the old psychopath. They don't get nervous. They don't... They can look somebody in the eye and be like, yeah, I'm just here on the bike path, chilling out. Yeah, so what had happened is he put these dismembered bodies and the little girl. They don't think that the girl saw the house. Like maybe she was blindfolded or something because she didn't know anything about
her mom was going on. Brother or dad.
No, she didn't know. She just knew she was kidnapped.
Baby.
So he dropped her off at his house, put her in that basement, then left. He drove to the Cocosing. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. The Cocosing Wildlife Area, which was apparently he was a big outdoorsman and he went there a lot and camped out a lot and, you know, liked trees a lot. He, with a rope and pulley system, he pulled their body parts up and put them into a 60-foot hollow tree. And hid them there. So
holy shit, that like wouldn't even cross my mind.
Yes. No. It's like it's beyond the perfect and most obscure hiding place. The police were like, if we didn't make the deal,
because
he said, I'll tell you where the bodies are if you don't give me the death penalty. The police were like, if we didn't do that, we would have never found these
bodies.
That
blows my mind because I have this, you know, this in mind of like, what, like, where are all the bodies? Like, there are over the whole globe, there are bodies hidden in crazy forests and weird places. And that wouldn't even fucking cross my mind. Now I have a whole nother fucking thing to worry about.
Well, and also because it's up so high
up.
That, like, it's all this premeditation, it's this plan, it's this, like, everything about it. And then it also makes me go, like, oh, who put Bella in the witch home?
Yeah.
It's that weird, like, the tree thing. It's real.
Oh God. Now I have a whole nother thing to worry about.
Yeah. It's so crazy. We can lump it right into just the forest issue that we always do.
Yeah.
File it under that.
Yeah. It's just not going to be buried this time.
Right. Okay. Basically, he planned to then, once he went and picked that truck up, he was going to take it back to her house, burn the house down, and get rid of all the evidence. God. That was his plan. Uh-huh. And then he told police that he also planned to, he said he was really nice to the daughter and that he planned to just keep her for a little while. They played video games, they read books, they watched movies. Mm-hmm. He gave her hamburgers, blah, blah, blah. And then he was just going to let her run away. She'd be home by Christmas is what he told the fucking police. Like he had this whole fantasy that he was a good guy and he was
very
good.
He didn't want to do these things, but he was put in this, what a fucking dick.
Well, and also just mental illness gone beyond rampant, like just untreated, terrible, you know, whatever. So, essentially, so they have, of course, these newspapers have interviewed the neighbors and this guy has so many neighbors. It's amazing. And they all have something to say. One of the neighbors said, there's only two trees near this guy's house. So neighbor Jeanette Collumber said he can't have possibly got that many leaves from that tree. So he has to haul leaves in here from somewhere.
Do we know what the deal with the leaves are?
I mean,
he's just obsessed with them.
Yes. It's like they did interview, and I think this is from the Columbus Dispatch. They interviewed a guy named Dr. N.G. Beryl, who is the director of the New York Center for Neuropsychology and Forensic Behavioral Science.
That guy
says you would have to talk to this guy to understand what the connection is, but it's clear that this guy is mentally ill beyond what we associate with normal serial killers or murderers or psychopaths, because normally serial killers are not technically mentally ill. They have these character disturbances, but they know what's happening and they know that they're doing wrong. They like it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason they get pleasure and gratification from how the terrible things they're doing and the torture that they are inflicting on other people. He thinks that this guy had some other thing happening and there was like obviously lots of other issues at hand.
God.
It's so fucking nuts. So, the neighbor, let's see. So Jeanette said, I don't know where those leaves could have come from because there's no trees around here. Yeah. Then a neighbor named Henderson Butcher says that Matthew Hoffman was friendly, but used to play around the trees a lot, around there a lot. He'd throw ropes up in the trees and had like a hammock up in there. So in some part of the neighborhood that did have trees, he would go in and be in them all the time.
Okay, fine.
Right?
Fine. That's fine.
Just go do that.
Yeah.
A lot of people like trees. Donna Davis, D-A-W-N-A, my favorite spelling of Donna ever. Aww. It's all the good 70s names combined into one name. She was another next door neighbor. Mm-hmm. And she said that she told her children to stay indoors when Matthew Hoffman was outside.
Oh, that's chill.
Yeah. And she said that he had moved in alone a year before. And that his girlfriend had lived with him temporarily and then she moved out a month before the murders. And this is what she said to the Denver Post. He'd sit up and listen to us up in a tree. He had a hammock and he would just sit there and listen to us.
Oh my God.
He was just different. He was very different. And
oh my God.
She said that he walked to Foundation Park almost every day and was a quote nature person who collected leaves. So I guess Foundation Park was a park, the park nearby that the other neighbor's talking about.
Yeah.
And he would just go up in there. Also, his house was in foreclosure. And it had been, it started in January. So he was, I think, at the end of like a serious, probably psychotic break.
Yeah.
He makes that huge confession.
Uh-huh.
He also killed the fucking family dog.
No. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So once he makes the confession and he asked the investigator, if I write down the location of the bodies, he hadn't given away the location yet.
Yeah.
And he said, if I write these down, can I then make a fake, like attempt to escape and you shoot me? And the cop was like, no, we're not going to do it that way.
Yeah.
And so then he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't tell them where the bodies were for 2 full days. And then he finally told them that whole story that I just told you.
Oh my God. The
police, of course, when they saw it, were just like, yeah, we had to make this deal with him because we would have never known.
Sure.
So in the end, Matthew Hoffman pled guilty to 10 felonies, including aggravated murder and rape, and he was given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And the Knox County prosecutor, John Thatcher, said that this Knox County has never seen a case like this before. It has to rank in Ohio history as one of the worst homicide cases ever.
My favorite murder history, too.
I mean...
Dude, so like, I thought those leaves would like have something about like he buried the bodies and had to put the leaves somewhere.
Well, that psychiatrist that they talked to said, you know, obviously this is all, he has some kind of a delusion and some kind of an obsession. So in his mind, somewhere in his mind, and he would be the only person that would be able to explain mm-hmm. what that connection is. But right now, there's nobody that can say, oh, he did trees because murder because of trees. Mm. Da, da, da. But like just coming upon a picture of a living room filled mm-hmm. with fucking leaves.
The bathroom's more troubling to me, of just perfect bags lined up and like whatever stapled to the wall.
It's almost like inverted hoarders, like the same feeling yeah. I had the first time I saw hoarders, but it's organized and only leaves.
Yeah.
And on the wall.
And then you got to be like, what happened?
What's going
on? Tell me everything now.
Yes. Oh. Meanwhile, it's a grown man that climbs and plays in trees.
Who like was able to buy a house and have a girlfriend and like it's so crazy. And plan the disposal of bodies in a really smart way.
Yes. Well, yes. Because once he was in it, it was like, that is the truth. Like that, that psychologist that gave the, or psychiatrist, whatever he was, that gave the difference. It's like, yes, he was mentally ill, clearly, mm-hmm. but he also knew what he did was wrong, covered it up. Like, yes, there was something going on, but you can't, it's the insanity defense, I don't think could apply because he covered up and hid those bodies
yeah.
and hit a girl
yeah,
and raped a fucking girl. Yeah. Like, you know, this wasn't some kind of like, I went all over the place. This isn't like Richard Chase, that Sacramento Vampire, where you're like, what the fuck are you doing, dude?
Yeah. God damn it.
Anyway, that's the Matthew Hoffman case of Mount Vernon.
Jesus. I don't know how I would have reacted on stage to this.
Well, I mean, it would have felt like this. It's fucking, like, we're just like, ugh.
Oh, man. Well, mine isn't much happier.
Okay.
But it's interesting.
Okay, good.
All right.
That's all we ask.
That's all we need from you, people. You're not. What?
What?
This is our job. Okay.
If you're like me, you're always looking for a story to dive into. Whether it's a family drama or a mystery to solve, the key to getting hooked is the details. I need rich visuals and intricate storylines, and June's Journey has that and more. June's Journey is a mobile mystery game that follows June Parker, a daring young woman, on a quest to uncover the truth about her sister's murder. This is your chance to test your detective skills because you'll play the game as June herself. Explore beautifully designed scenes from the 1920s, like lavish estates and gardens, and don't forget to keep an eye out for hidden clues. There are twists, turns, and catchy tunes, all leading you deeper into the thrilling storyline. And if you play well enough, you could make it to the Detective Club. There, you'll chat with other players and compete with or against them. June needs your help, but watch out, you never know which character might be a villain. Shocking family secrets will be revealed, but will you crack the case? Find out as you escape this world and dive into June's world of mystery, murder, and romance. It's all just one tap away. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. That's June's Journey. Download the game for free on iOS and Android. Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know, it sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound
means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
All right. Well, this is one I hadn't ever heard of.
Okay.
Even though it's basically the French JonBenet.
Oh.
Have you heard of this one?
Madeleine McCann?
No. Oh. It's the French Madeleine McCann.
Oh, okay. An actual French citizen.
That's English.
Right.
It's the Madeleine McCann JonBenet.
En français.
In French.
Got it. French bread. French dressing.
But with a side of French. This is L'Affaire de Petit Gregory, or the case of Little Gregory.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay.
Already awful.
It's one of France's most high-profile murders. So in 1981, in the small village of near Vallon in eastern France, 26-year-old Jean-Marie Villemin is promoted to foreman at the car parts factory where he works. So after his promotion, Jean-Marie and his wife, Christine, who's 24, like so young, right?
Yes.
Start receiving threatening anonymous phone calls from a person who knows a shit ton about their family. And he calls himself the Raven.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So this person is calling, threatening. This person has a hoarse voice, or it's a woman disguising her voice. I listened to one of the recordings from way back when, and it sounds like a fucking woman to me, for sure.
Was it super creepy?
Yeah. It's not even creepy. They're having a conversation.
Oh, no.
All right. So the person is angry with Jean-Marie. Once Jean-Marie had been promoted, they think he's putting on airs. He's got a lot of money. He's not joining the union. Mm. And so a lot of the articles about this in like every video is in French.
Sure.
So it's really hard to get information. I had to do a lot of Google translation bullshit. So some of it might be off. Like the Raven thing, it's called the Crow in a lot of different translations.
Which is a totally different horrible death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
always ask me for French stuff because I took all the way up through French too.
So Vallange is Vallange?
It's Vallanges.
Right. There's some fucked up things here.
Okay.
So they're pissed off at Jean-Marie. The Villemins, they alert the police and they begin recording the phone calls. And so at that point, the phone calls stop and instead threatening letters start coming.
Do you think the Raven knew the phone calls were being recorded?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it sounds like someone who was close to the family.
Oh, okay.
So maybe even knew.
Like a mole.
Yeah, that's totally a mole. So these threatening letters start coming in. There are these rambling letters written in, quote, longhand and low-class slang.
Oh.
The letters are signed the Raven and say such things as, I'll have all your hides and I hate you so much. The day you die, I will spit on your grave. And it's sent to the whole family, like, you know, the grandparents and all these things.
God.
So a window of the house is broken in the Villemin house while Christine is at home alone with the couple's young son named Gregory.
Oh no.
And also all the tires are slashed on the family cars. So someone is threatening them and it's a small town and the person knows a lot about them. The harassment goes on for 3 years.
Whoa.
Without the Villemins or the police having any idea who was behind it. And then on October 16th, 1984, At around 5:30 p.m., Christine, who's inside doing some ironing, goes out to bring Gregory in. He's 4 years old at this point, and she had left him outside to play in the sand beside their house, and he's not there.
Oh, God.
No, it gets worse. She gets in her car to drive around the small town looking for him, thinking maybe he just wandered off. But at that point, Jean-Marie's brother receives a call at work from an unidentified person telling him, I have taken the boy.
Oh.
So a search begins, but by 9:30 that same night, Gregory is found in the Vallon River, 4 miles from his home.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So this is like, think there's so many similarities to JonBenet case in this. So little Gregory, he's this sweet boy. There's this photo of him in the same way that the photo of JonBenet looking all smiley and beautiful is, you know, known to us for ages. This photo of Gregory is the same thing. He's sweet, smiling boy with messy, curly hair, little 4-year-old. He's found bound hand and foot. He's fully dressed. There's a photo taken at the scene by a journalist. It's a roped firefighter holding in his arms and like taking Gregory out of the river. He's fully dressed in his blue anorak, dark green velvet trousers, and his like beanie still on his head.
Oh.
And it's published in the press the next day, and it traumatizes all of France, and everyone becomes obsessed with this case.
Yeah.
So he's dead. Did I say that?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, yeah.
You figure. Okay. The next day, Christine and Jean-Marie receive an anonymous letter that says to Jean-Marie, addressed to him, I hope you die of grief, boss. Your money can't give you back your son. Here is my revenge, you stupid bastard.
Holy fuck.
In the same way that the JonBenet fucking letter was, it's so similar, right?
Oh.
Remember?
Yes. But that was a fake ransom letter.
Right. But it was like, your money can't help you.
Yeah. That's true.
You know what I mean?
That's right. Like, I'm jealous of your riches. Yeah.
Okay. So the investigation doesn't fucking start well. The lead investigator put on the case, he's the only investigating magistrate in the district. He's 32-year-old Jean-Michel Lambert. It's his very first investigation.
No.
32.
Oh.
Can you? I wouldn't trust a 32-year-old to watch my fucking purse for 5 minutes.
Dude.
Sorry, Steven. How old are you?
30.
Fuck.
Wait a second. My wallet's gone. Steven. No, that's too young.
Too young.
You need experienced people.
Yeah.
It's a big fucking difference. You need people when it's an important thing. People have to know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They have to have experience. Mm-hmm. They can't be in a state of, I need to prove myself.
That's exactly right. It's less like, I don't know what I'm doing than, I don't know what I'm doing and I need to act like I know what I'm doing.
Yes.
So I'm going to fucking overdo it.
I can't listen.
That's exactly what happens.
You can't help me. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, it's the same thing with the JonBenet when they sent the young and experienced cops on Christmas fucking day. All right. So 32-year-old Jean-Michel Lambert, first investigation. First of all, he fails to secure the crime scene. And he also doesn't order a full autopsy. So the autopsy has been criticized forever because it was incomplete and sloppy. So they don't know. There's no bruises on the body. Pathologists attribute the death to drowning and contact with the cold water. They're not totally sure. They disagree whether he had been drowned in the river or in tap water. Because the water in his lungs contained none of the microscopic organisms that one would find in the river.
Ew, that's awful.
I know, but they didn't do enough. But Lambert was like kind of trying to spare the parents by not making them over autopsy poor Gregory.
It doesn't work that way.
No, unfortunately.
I mean, ultimately.
Yeah. So from the beginning, suspicion falls on the family of Jean-Marie, the father. His parents, brothers, aunts, uncles, and cousins all live nearby. And when Jean-Marie is promoted to foreman way back when, some of the family members had been unhappy about it. So they think that the person who was writing the letters, the Raven and the killer, might be part of his family.
Out of like jealousy,
yeah.
Basically?
And he has a big family that all lives in this area.
Okay.
So, police force hundreds of 140 members of the Villemin family to take handwriting and dictation tests to compare them to the letters and phone calls that have been going on.
Wow.
140.
Wow.
They copied pages of the writing, including the text of the last message from the Raven. And after a month after Gregory's murder, the 15-year-old sister-in-law of Jean-Marie's cousin. So Jean-Marie, the dad of Gregory, his cousin, whose name is Bernard LaRoche, his cousin's sister-in-law, this is confusing, who's 15 years old. So she's just like nerdy, redheaded 15-year-old, totally early 80s, like not much, maybe a Duran Duran shirt on, but like no makeup. She's not like punk rock or whatever.
Jean jacket. I see her. I can see her.
Yeah.
A comb holding one side of her hair back.
Yeah, but like really nerdy comb.
Yeah. A math comb.
You know.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a ruler.
Uh-huh.
She's 15 years old. She comes forward and tells investigators that the cousin, her brother-in-law, who's married to her sister, 29-year-old Bernard LaRoche, is the murderer.
Oh, fuck.
She tells them that the day Gregory was killed, she had been picked up by Bernard from high school and taken to the Villemans' house. They picked up Gregory and headed for the river, and then they parked and Bernard went off with him and came back alone.
What?
So she's fucking pinning it all on her sister's husband.
Okay.
Who's this like smiley, big, boisterous looking, mustachioed, messy 80s hair dude.
Okay.
Played by like a young, Roseanne's husband on Roseanne?
John Goodman?
Like a young John Goodman.
I was thinking Vincent D'Onofrio.
No, not okay. More jovial. Looking.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
A good time guy.
Totally.
Got it.
But like, why are you smiling inappropriately in this photograph?
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, there's a photograph of the three, of the cousin, his wife, and his wife's, and the young Muriel. Her name's Muriel Boyle. There's a photograph of the three of them, and I just want to know if it's taken before or after the murder, because it's inappropriately smiling and creepy.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, ugh.
There's something about it.
French people are screaming what they think about really happened. And I want to know.
They're like, actually, we're supposed to smile like this way.
Right. So why are you smiling? Okay.
I used to work with an over-smiler actually, I'm positive, was a sociopath.
Because they don't know when it's appropriate, so they just do it the whole time.
Right, and it's this thing of, it's almost like that weird hypnosis kind of thing where it's just like, yes, everything's fine. Like, right. They're trying to control you with their mouth.
Right.
With their teeth.
They learn that people mimic things, so they just fucking do it.
Yeah, like, here, this is friends.
See?
Yeah.
See?
It was like someone always trying to show you that they're happy and smiley.
Right.
Means they're covering something.
And you know inherently, but you're like, but they seem so happy.
Yeah, I have to mimic what they're doing because they're setting the tone of the room, which is, we love everything.
And then when you get older and stop giving a shit about anything, you realize, like, you don't have to do that. Like, when I stop being that way, which I am inherently like a person who will mimic a person's happiness because I'm just uncomfortable that way.
Yeah.
And I don't do it. Then I'm like, oh, this isn't right.
Yeah.
I don't want to be here.
It's well, cause it's like, why is this person trying to control me this hard? Like, what do they not want me to be paying attention to?
Right.
I mean,
this is that photograph.
Oy.
In a nutshell from the 80s.
Okay.
With a mustache. Steven.
Wait, okay. Are you French, Steven?
Uh-huh.
Oui.
Uh-huh. Oui. Okay. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. So she says that, ba-ba-ba. And then, okay, so Bernard, this guy Bernard, the cousin, and Jean-Marie had played together as children. So they're from the same clan. It's like a clan more than a family. It's almost like Fargo, that second season, when they're like the big criming family.
The crimey family?
They didn't fight crime. They crimed. But they had grown apart over the years, and Bernard was an unkempt, often profane man with a mustache. And he and his wife, they also had a 4-year-old child, but he had a learning disability.
Okay.
So they both had 4-year-old children, but Gregory was this beautiful, smiling, happy baby that everyone loved. And Jean-Marie had been promoted. He was getting all this money. His dad was in charge of the plant. Well, meanwhile, Bernard seemed to have a shitty fucking life.
Right.
So they didn't socialize anymore with Jean-Marie and Christine, but so he wouldn't have known about the family a lot enough to write these Raven letters. But one of Jean-Marie's brothers was good friends with LaRoche, so he would have known.
Okay.
He didn't like the Villemans, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So this chick Muriel's like, my fucking brother-in-law did it. I'm 15. What's up?
Yeah.
At the spot where Muriel said they had stopped, the investigators find a vial of insulin and a syringe they find on the ground.
Okay.
They make the investigators think that Gregory had been put into a hypoglycemic coma before being thrown into the river.
Okay.
So that made him unable to
do anything.
Right. And yeah, he was also tied up.
Yeah.
So, but there had been no toxicology report because the autopsy wasn't done correctly. So they didn't know. They didn't look for needle marks, anything like that. And so Muriel says she wasn't aware of what her uncle was doing. She had just been sitting in the car. But it turns out that Muriel's mother, Janine, was a diabetic, and that Muriel was her insulin injector.
Oh.
So she might have been more involved than she said she was.
Because she would know how to do it.
Right. Or she would even have provided them with it.
But then why would she fucking go to the cops and say he did it? Like, if she's involved.
That's a great question. So why would she do it? No. It's true. Why would she do it anyway? There's a lot of questions here.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, that's the first. And most.
She's 15 and feels and isn't an adult and knows there's right and wrong. And your fucking bullshit fights with families don't matter.
Yeah, because that's such a huge, it's such a stretch from I hate my rich cousin who gets everything to I'm going to kill a child.
Like, not even kill your cousin. Fine. Kill an adult man.
Yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
But to take away the child is such a, I want you to suffer specifically.
Yes. The
it's
most
crazy.
It's so awful.
Right. Okay. So, they test Bernard's handwriting, and experts say he had written two of the poison pen letters, including the one sent the day after the murder. So they say it's Bernard.
It matches
him. It matches him.
And this is in the time where they knew nothing about handwriting analysis. Like, that's back in the Zodiac times where they're like, nah, it's not him.
It's almost like it's in a time when they thought they knew everything about handwriting analysis. And now we know that they know nothing about handwriting. You know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like the opposite where they're like, you can tell everything from that. And
yeah,
now we're like, no, you can't do that.
Right. You're making all kinds of insane assumptions.
Exactly. And, yeah, and you sound really fucking smart.
Yeah.
Right. So Bernard is arrested. And then Muriel gets the 15-year-old gets sent back to her family's house, and a couple days later retracts her entire statement.
What?
Everyone is like, Muriel like was bullied by her family into retracting that statement.
Oh.
Everyone thinks that.
Okay. How dare you turn on the family? How dare you?
On the yeah, brother-in-law, this, you know, there's like insane like family, like going back probably hundreds of years within this small community with this family,
right,
or these families. And against the prosecutor's advice, Lambert, the police investigating 31-year-old dude, so the police investigator, even though the public prosecutor's like, don't fucking do this, they let Bernard go.
What?
Because she retracts her statement, and they're like, well, then let's let her go.
But then that's it.
Well,
there's, because then there's no evidence that he's involved.
Well, they were saying there's other evidence, right? So
yeah,
why wasn't he held?
Oy, oy.
Okay. On the day of his release, Jean-Marie, Gregory's dad, in front of a bunch of journalists, vows that he would kill his cousin Bernard.
Of course he did.
Right. He vows to kill Bernard.
To journalists. Oh.
The LaRoche family tries to get police protection, but the police are like, nope.
Oh, no.
Nope. You can't have it. And so, true to his fucking word, on March 29th, Jean-Marie waits outside his cousin's house. And when he gets home, pulls up, he fucking approaches his cousin, Bernard, and shoots him with a hunting rifle.
Oh, fuck.
Bernard dies.
Oh, my God.
The cousin dies.
Goodbye, John Goodman. He's out of the picture.
Jean
Goodman
is dead. It's like if fucking John Ramsey had shot, you know, his boss. It's just insane.
Yes.
These steps people are taking.
Also, it seems like reverse police work where it's like, let them go. Don't investigate.
Right.
Like, don't get details going.
Yeah.
Like, everything is, it feels like.
Arrest someone now. Quickly. and then let them go and then try this. And it's just like
panic.
It's amping everyone up.
Yes. And especially small town, like anywhere in the world,
like Boulder.
Yes.
You know,
exactly. Small town life where everyone knows everyone's business and there's gossip and there's pressure.
Okay. Exactly. So Bernard dies. Jean-Marie immediately turns himself in and he's sentenced to 5 years for the killing.
Whoa.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Lambert, the police dude, is like, I know who fucking did this. I'll tell you who fucking did this. And he starts to build a case against Gregory's mother, Christine.
Whoa.
For the murder of her son. At this point, she's 6 months pregnant, too. Let's add that in for fun. Because this is a fucking Lifetime movie. Apparently.
Yes. He's saying that the mother killed her son.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
This 33-year-old fucking investigator.
He's been 31, 32, and 33.
They're all the same. Everyone knows.
Well, time is passing, actually.
Right.
Okay.
So, three locals who worked with Christine swore that they saw her at the post office on the day before Gregory's death when the revenge letter had been posted, which is like, I don't think it was true, but also who gives a fucking shit, you know?
Like they're saying they saw her mail the revenge letter?
They're saying they saw her the day the revenge letter was mailed at the post office.
Okay.
All right. Graphologists argued that there was an 80% chance that she was the letter's author. So again, with the fucking JonBenet ransom letter.
Right.
And we're all like, right.
But then they'd already said that he.
Right. That he signed that. They said, yeah. Yeah. They already said that the cousin was.
Right. If they're just changing it per this. Okay. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And string that was identical to what was used to tie up Gregory is found in the cellar of the Villemans home.
Oh, no.
But it's like, does that, I don't know. Who knows?
The bag I could have taken it there.
Right.
That's the one string they sell in this village.
Sure. Also, in the Raven's letters, he accuses Christine of killing Gregory. So they start to believe what the fucking Raven is saying. Because Gregory had been conceived. So they're saying Christine had been knocked up with Gregory in an extramarital affair. And that's why she killed her son, which ultimately wasn't true, proven to be untrue.
Ooh, that's fucked up.
Yeah.
Because then they're just floating salacious shit that people love to repeat.
And keep in mind, this whole time, if you were alive during the JonBenet Ramsey investigation, it is the fucking media is going out of their fucking minds.
Yeah.
You know, front page glossy bullshit in every grocery store. I don't know what they have in France that's equivalent to that. It's going on. Everyone is eating it up and all these crazy theories are being, you know, just thrown about.
Yeah. I think they have one big magazine called Paris Match and it's just pictures of people smoking and then terrible stories like this.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah.
Christine ends up getting charged with the murder of her son.
No fucking way.
Way.
Oh, because it's this guy's idea.
Yeah.
He's the
Lambert.
I was going to say the king of police. He's the French king of police.
He is the king. So the king of police, Lambert, charges Christine with this murder of her son.
Fuck.
Based on this evidence. Places her in a pre-trial detention in July of 1985. In protest, she goes on a fucking 11-day hunger strike and is released. And it isn't until...
Wait, sorry. That works?
I guess. She's pregnant.
Remember? Oh, no.
Yeah. So she's released, and it isn't until... But they also, I think, didn't have anything to hold her on.
Right.
Cut to 1993. It isn't until 1993 when the case is taken over by another investigating judge. Finally, someone who's hopefully over 50. Maurice Simon.
For real.
That she's cleared. So between 1985 and 1993, people are speculating whether or not it's her constantly. And Maurice Simon is like, does some fucking, you know, judgy magic thing, sprinkle something on her that's like, she's never allowed to be fucking tried for this again. Like,
oh, good.
Makes it so she can never be brought up as a suspect again.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing.
That's like, isn't that double jeopardy?
No, because she had never been brought to trial.
Oh, but he was just saying like, this is now put to rest.
Yeah, you can't bring her up as a fucking suspect again.
Yeah. Seems pretty decent.
Yeah.
The mother of the dead child.
Right.
Yeah.
And like photos of her man at this time are heartbreaking. There's a lot of photos going on and it's so 80s and so sad. Okay. And then in 2000, the year 2000. You've heard of it. The case is reopened when Christine's family demands that DNA tests are carried out on the fucking stamps that are in the fucking letters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately, there's hundreds of these letters. Three separate traces of DNA are found, but none of them are identified.
What?
For some reason, none of these fucking... Okay. Not much happens until this past June of 2017.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're both fucking...
We're all about 2017.
We're currenting this fucking episode.
I love it.
So in June, 32 years after Gregory's murder, no one has been taken into custody for the murder since 1985 when his mother was fucking taken into custody. So no one has even been a suspect. Three people in connection with the case are taken into custody.
Whoa.
Okay, ready for this?
Yes.
So, okay, the aunt and uncle of Jean-Marie, Gregory's father, and Bernard, the dead cousin, Jacqueline Jacob, she's 72, and her husband, Marcel, is 71, are arrested.
No fucking way.
These fucking old people.
And they were like in their 40s at the time?
30, yeah.
80s, 90s.
Yeah, 40s.
Okay.
So, okay, it's so fucking confusing. So, Marcel Jacob, the husband, the dude, is one of the younger brothers of... Okay, it's basically Jean-Marie's... dad married Marcel's sister.
Okay.
It's Gregory's great aunt and uncle.
Got it.
Okay. They're charged with kidnapping and confinement, but not the murder, saying they were responsible for the murder of Gregory since he would not have died unless he had first been kidnapped. So they think fucking this chick Jacqueline, who's now 72, was the fucking mastermind of this whole entire thing and made Bernard, was the letter writer and the woman. It sounds like a woman.
She's the Raven.
Yeah, she's the Raven. But they're all involved and all hate this family. And the day of, Bernard actually did the murder, but she was like the distraction and the mastermind.
Whoa. This is like the second season of Fargo.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's totally like Fargo.
It really is. Because also it's just that, like, what for? What are you doing? Like, what is this plan?
Totally. And why the kid?
Yeah.
It's such a...
sick.
It's like to hurt as much as possible. Also questioned are Albert and Monique Villemin, the parental grandparents of Gregory, 86 and 85 years old. So Gregory's fucking grandparents on his father's side, on Jean-Michel's side, are questioned as well.
Okay.
Like, everyone hated Jean-Marie and were in on this.
Even his own parents?
They're questioned.
Wow.
So the charges against the great aunt and uncle follow a modern handwriting and handwriting and linguistic analysis of some 2,000 letters of the Raven letters and voice recordings that lead police to conclude that the authors are a man and a woman.
Okay.
More than 100 witnesses are also interviewed, some 12,000 pieces of evidence run through an advanced artificial intelligence program called Anacrime, which sounds fucking so cool, that locates potential suspects at given moments and uncovers inconsistencies in statements and alibis.
How?
I think it's basically like this person says, I was there. And this person said, you were like, and the pings are from here and puts them all together. And it's like, whatever they're saying isn't true. There's no way they could have been there.
Because it's basically based on like how we're digitally and kind of in some way recorded at all times.
I don't even think that at that point. I think it's just based on statements. Who said you were here? Who said you were there? You said you were here.
Oh, that makes sense. Because they're talking to so many people.
Right. So they put them all together and they're like, this person wasn't where they said they were based on everyone's testimony.
And the scariest part about Anacrime is that they're also those robots that can open doors now. Did you see that video today?
Yes.
That bothered me so much. It bothered me all day long.
I didn't watch more than him walking because it looked like a spider.
It looks like a spider. And then there was a part where it turns before it opens the door with a creepy long vacuum cleaner tube.
No.
And it does this like click, click where it moves really fast to one side. And it's so unnatural. Like it looks very animal like. Mm-hmm. And then it goes click, click. And you're like, oh, what are we? I don't even know what this is.
It's like we want the end days to come.
Yeah. We're forcing it quick.
Yeah. It's like we're begging it and creating the end days.
Yeah. It's like some really smart guy that loves robots and computers,
yeah,
also watched the Terminator too many times. And he's like, we got to make this happen, guys.
But he never saw the beginning of the Terminator, like the first scene in the boardroom.
Right.
He's like, this all looks great.
And he didn't watch the romantic parts, because I argue that the Terminator, the first one, is one of the most romantic movies of all time.
It's pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
God. And he goes to see his wife and sees her gardening. Is that the right movie?
I think, yes. When he goes and he walks by before, yeah, he knows, like, he's gone.
He sees something and he's like that. Yeah.
Also, just, you gotta love a guy that keeps a picture with him of the girl that he loves.
Can I just tell you that I don't know what year it came out in, but it was way too early for me to watch it. And that scene in the boardroom in the beginning when the Terminator just kills everyone, mm-hmm, it was so traumatic for me.
I bet. Yeah, no, that's, it's this horrifying, amazing movie.
It's so good though.
Can I tell you a quick, just do a quick sidebar of Valentine's Day?
Always Valentine's Day.
That just reminded me, the picture thing just reminded me. We have family friends named the Mulkeens. Mm-hmm. So one of my dad's best friends is Kevin Gary, and his sister Marilyn Mulkeen is the woman, remember that high school picture I showed you where I'm leaning against a ladder and I have almost a unibrow?
Always. Where you look like one of Kelly Bundy's best friends. You look like Kelly Bundy's, like, why Kelly Bundy got into trouble.
That's right. I'm her smoking friend.
Yes.
So Marilyn Mulkeen was, also because it's so small town, she also lived next door to my best friend, Christine Gooden. So she took Christine's senior portrait. She took mine. She took everybody. She was like a really great photographer. Mm-hmm. And when we were, I can't remember where we were one time, she told me the story of how her and her husband, Tom, like, got together. They were, childhood, he was friends with her, with Kevin, and with the boys in the Gary family. Mm-hmm. They were all on vacation at the Russian River. I think the boys were like 14 or 13, and she was like 11 or 12.
Oh,
and I tell this story because Marilyn died in November of cancer. Oh. And it makes me super sad because I hadn't seen her in a long time, and she's truly one of the coolest. She was like one of those cool people,
yeah,
of your parents' friends where you're like, oh, I want to talk to her.
She's
for
like,
5
I'm going
to
tell you how it is because no one else is.
Yes. Like, she really was a legit rad lady. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sad that she's passed
away. I'm so sorry.
But I still have this story and I love it so much. So she is a 12-year-old girl, is watching these boys play in roughhouse, and they all grab Tom, and who is like, you know, her older brother's cute friend, mm-hmm, and they're about to throw him into the Russian River. And so he pulls his wallet out of his back pocket and he tosses it to Marilyn. He goes, hold that for me, as they throw him into the water, and she catches it and it falls open in her hands, and he has a picture of her in his wallet. And they were married for 51 years.
Oh my God.
And that is my favorite. That's just a little sidebar Valentine's Day story. It's my favorite love story of, like, when you are a 12-year-old girl and they're like a boy, the idea that a boy would have your school picture in his wallet, like, you're the girl I like love. And then they actually end up married.
The crush you have at 12 years old
It never burns that bright.
Never.
Again.
Because it's so innocent.
And it's also so, like, idealistic. Like, you know, it's like when you're 12, you don't pick bad boys. You pick, like,
yeah,
it's like, oh, he's nice. Or, like, he said something nice to me or
right,
something.
Or he has freckles or some stupid,
some dumb shit. Or he's just in the living room. Sometimes it's that. But I love, anyway.
He's not mean to me like my brother. Oh, God.
That's my favorite Valentine's story. And I just sidebarred you so hard. Sorry.
But that was beautiful.
Okay, good, good.
I love it. Let's get back to this little boy being murdered. Okay. The Jacob's alibi. So the Anacrime's like, beep, boop, bop. I'm a machine.
Yeah.
And the old folks, the Jacob's alibi are, quote, unconfirmed and unsubstantiated.
Oh.
So Anacrime is like, hell fucking no.
Ooh.
You lying fucking liars.
We need Anacrime.
Anacrime, when you're in your 40s, you're fucking lying. Also arrested is fucking Muriel Bowl, remember her? The fucking little 15-year-old? She's arrested at this point for complicity in murder and non-report of a crime. So they're like, you knew more than you were saying at the time.
Yeah.
And we're finally getting down to cases. However, so she goes on a hunger strike again for a few days. Whatever. A month after they're arrested, let's go back. Remember Jean-Michel Lambert, the 30-whatever-the-fuck-year-old?
Cop?
Investigator who got taken off of the case.
Yes.
In July of 2017, just a few months ago. He's 65 years old. He's found dead in his apartment from suicide.
What?
A plastic bag over his head. By 1987, he had been replaced by Maurice, as we said, and Maurice wrote at the time in his personal notebooks that Lambert had an intellectual disorder, and he said, "I am in the midst of a miscarriage of justice in all its horror."
Oh.
About the accusations against Gregory's mother. In his suicide note, Lambert proclaims his certainty about the innocence of Bernard, but he says he no longer has the strength to fight. So at this point, he still thinks that, I don't know, the mother is responsible or whatever, whatever he thinks, that Bernard is not guilty.
Right. He can't let go of his own first instinctual theory.
Right.
Yeah.
We also learned several other letters have been sent since the restart of the investigation in June. A prosecutor has been threatened with death by the Raven.
What? So the Raven's back.
Letters are still being fucking written.
Holy shit.
By 2014, nearly 3,000 press articles, about 50, papers, a TV movie, and 15 books have been made about this case, and it's still ongoing. And so we will update you when we find out. But that is the case of the affair of the Petite Gregory.
Oh,
the case of little Gregory.
That is so heavy.
How have we never heard of that?
I've never heard any of that.
I must have seen it late night in one of those listy things that you've never heard of, and saw this photo of this sweet little boy with this, he's so French and cute and sweet and messy little hair and
horrible.
It's just awful.
Well, and also just that it sounds like things are so bad, so entrenched, that people have just went insane. Like, they were surrounded by their family and their competition and their small town bullshit.
Well, it's like, you look at this story and you're like, how could this have happened? And then this happened and it's so insane. And then you're like, well, the same thing happened with JonBenet, and I'm still fucking casting aspersions and being like, it was the brother.
Of course.
Or it was this or it was that. And then the mom dies of cancer, and I'm still like, maybe she had something to do with it. Or the letter looked like her handwriting. And we're doing the exact same thing.
Because you want some fucking clarity. Yeah. You just want someone to step forward and go, yes, all this other shit has happened. It's just same with Jack the Ripper. But you just want someone to come and go, we finally have the one, we have who did
it. Here's the answer.
The answer. Clean, clear, not involving 17 relatives or whatever. Yeah. Just like, who fucking, whose plan was this and who did it?
Well, I think, and fucking French people, please let me know what everyone thinks, because I have no way of knowing if everyone's like, no, what are you talking about? Everyone knew this person wasn't involved.
Right.
That I'm saying is guilty. I have no way, I can't give my opinion because I can't fucking understand any of the fucking videos.
I don't understand half of what's going
half
on.
Half of it. Like, literally, there's like 5 articles in English and like 2 videos that you can put subtitles on.
Bonjour, français.
Yeah. But faster. But at a speed of 100.
Of asking. At the speed of 100, they're all like,
I don't understand any of it, but I want to know.
I know.
So,
well, that would be amazing if people actually have the like insider scoop
of, here's what we think.
Yeah,
I think what everyone thinks is that this great aunt and uncle, the great aunt especially, is like the devious fucking matriarch of the family who planned the whole thing, including alibis, and Bernard did it.
Fuck. Your own family? It's just dark.
I mean, I think it's just like this anger, jealousy situation. Oh, are you ending this with showing me those bowling socks again? Because everything is sad and awful, and that's the only light we have in our lives.
What if I hold up a bowling sock every time things go so dark into the human existence of...
That's all I want is a bowling sock.
Steven, look at it.
Steven, look at the bowling sock.
Steven was really bent over... He's really bent over just now.
Horrified.
Feeling those French feelings. And we just have to remember these bowling socks.
French feelings are stronger than regular feelings.
God damn, that's awful.
I know. Okay, so we're going to end this differently right now, right? You and I were talking about how I just don't want to keep fucking... We end the episode with thing that makes us happy, and yes. I'm just going to keep saying my cats or that my back doesn't hurt, and I'm fucking sick of myself. Right? So, like, we're going to save this for, like, what were we going to either read a thing or...
Well, I brought a thing. I have a thing.
Okay, great.
I tried to actually do something.
Great. And I have a recommendation that makes me really happy. So, like, after this episode, go watch this thing I'm going to tell you about. Because
Perfect.
This is the worst. So, great. So, Perfect. This is all new. We're giving it a shot.
It's basically we take the beginning and we're putting it at the end.
Yeah.
Because we decided we front load everything with all everything we love and are excited about. And then we drain ourselves with horror.
Yeah. And then it's like, what do you like? Well,
and then we're staring at each other going, what? Why haven't you gone to the movies?
You guys don't know that half the time at the end when we have to say a thing we're happy about, we have to make Steven cut out 10 minutes of us going, I don't know, suitcase, I don't know. Because it's just so depressing.
It's depressing, but also I think that we are afraid to overly plan. We just want to have this be the most natural right. conversation possible. I don't like the planny of like anytime I come with something in my pocket, it feels fake and clunky.
Yeah.
So I always think like when we get there, something's going to pop into my head that makes, you know what I love?
And then, but then you're like, I love hash browns. You're like, I just talked about a dead kid.
Yes.
This feels terrible.
It's not enough. It's never enough.
No. This is why Elvis meows at the end of every episode.
Yeah.
It's because when we did an episode once and we were like, how do we end this? I was like, oh shit, let's have Elvis meow.
Yes. Let's just start talking about something else yeah. entirely.
Let's have something. Okay. So that's what we're going to do. Mine is, do you want me to go first?
Sure.
It's not that great.
Do it.
It's just a good thing that I like. That's
great.
Light
Same with mine.
And fluffy. Okay. There's this Netflix show movie. It's a Netflix movie. It's a horror comedy about vampire roommates. Called What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes, girl.
Do you know it?
Yes.
Ugh.
It's the greatest.
It is so good. I have had the hardest time not talking to you about it. It's Jemaine from fucking Flight of the Conchords.
Jemaine Clement.
And is it Taiki Waititi?
I don't know how to pronounce that guy's name. I panic when I see it.
Oh, Steven knows.
Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi.
Look at Steven.
You're hired again.
At a lower rate.
At a lower rate. It is so perfect.
Amazing.
It's basically just like, oh my, it's perfection. Rhys Darby has a hilarious, we're werewolves, not swearwolves.
Yes.
Like, it's just so good. I want to cry.
Rhys Darby, I actually one day was sitting, staring at my TV, like, I cannot look at one more true crime anything.
Yeah.
Like, I really hit a wall. And then I went, randomly, my DVR recorded Flight of the Conchords, which uh-huh. is almost never rerun.
And like, all you need to do is binge watch Flight of the Conchords and you'll be happy.
I went straight to iTunes and bought both seasons or four seasons,
yeah.
whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, wait a second.
I could
watch this over and over for the rest of my life and be happy.
It's the best show ever.
I'm the hip hopopotamus.
My rhymes are bottomless. And then nothing. It's the best.
There's nothing better.
There's nothing. Maybe he did. Maybe he did what? He maybe did. He maybe did what? He maybe did.
He maybe did.
He maybe did.
Also, those posters behind Rhys Darby in the New Zealand office, ambassador's office, wherever they are the best.
It's perfection.
It's New Zealand.
What We Do in the Shadows is an extension of that.
Yes.
So, and I think they're going to bring it to this place we call America
Ugh.
And remake it here.
Yes.
But it's going to be Jemaine and Taika, who's so cute. The other thing is, I want to live in there because they're all hot.
They're so hot.
They're all the vampires, except for the really old one. Please go watch it. It's the best movie you've ever seen in your fucking life.
Yeah. If you haven't, it's so goddamn delightful.
Okay. So that made me really fucking happy. I'm going to watch it over and over again. Okay.
I told you the time I got to meet the Flight of the Conchords. I opened for them. When I very first started stand-up again after I hadn't done it for 5 years, one of my very first sets was opening for the Flight of the Conchords in Denver.
While they were like
it was the height. I think the show was still on.
Yeah.
I think it was like maybe their last season.
And they were like touring and shit.
I ate it in a way.
Were you doing music?
What?
Were you doing music?
No. I was trying to put a comedy set back together. And one of the main problems was that the mic cord was twisted around the mic stand probably 150 times. Like, there was no way I was getting the mic off the mic stand. So I had to stand there like fucking Steven Wright and deliver not set up punch jokes, like conversational shit. It was awful. I got a terrible review in one of their like local weekly papers where they said it should have been Kristen Schaal.
Oh,
because she's on the show and she's a Denver local. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was a horror show, but all that
That's
aside.
Horrible. Kristen Schaal, love you. That's horrible.
Look, I did it because I wanted to be around those guys and meet them.
No, there's no reason why you shouldn't have done it.
But except for that I didn't have an act. But they were so lovely. And Jemaine Clement, like, in my opinion, we don't have to go on and on about this. And we certainly don't have to debate it. But
Jemaine's hotter than... Is that what you're going to say?
I think Brett McKenzie is the hottest technically.
Yes.
But then...
But we like a big guy.
Well, also, when Jemaine Clement walks towards you to say hello, thank you for opening the show for us... A wind kicks up indoors and his hair blew back. There was a thing that happened where I was standing there like, what in the living fuck is coming toward me right now? I was
he's
weak
a vampire.
In the knees.
Also, like,
he's a monster.
You've seen his David Bowie impressions.
Yes.
You'll just never. There's nobody ever.
It's
listen, Vince doesn't listen to this podcast. Look and listen. My husband does not listen to this podcast, so it's fine.
So let her fly.
And there was, Vince and I were watching it together, and I kept wanting to go, I kept almost saying, because the guy that they turn into, I kept
yes, that guy's
like,
amazing.
They're so hot. Yes. I couldn't do that.
It's weird too. It's weird as American girls, I think, to see hot guys that are acting like sweet and innocent.
Yeah.
It's such a strange, not of my era anyway, combination.
And then they had like, I'm just going to keep talking about it. They had special effects that it was this low budget movie and then these insane special vampire effects.
Yes.
I'm going to watch it tonight again.
They just did it perfectly. Yeah. It was like a realistic docu-series almost, but oh, I know, it's so perfect.
It's called, I wrote down, The People Who Eat Darkness. That's not it. That is actually a really good book about a Japanese serial killer. Go listen to that, but it's actually called What We Do in the Shadows.
That's right, a different thing.
Yes.
But similar.
Okay.
Well, my thing is, I love it. Now that's my thing too. That's
great.
I'm support.
I see lotion in your hands.
Well, because we were given.
Oh yeah.
When we went to, I believe this was in either Atlanta or Nashville.
Uh-huh.
So this was a couple trips ago. So I'm sorry that I don't, as I always say, someone pointed out to me on Twitter that I'm always like, sorry, I don't remember your name. Sorry, I don't, whatever.
It was Kim.
But, I'm trying to look on here because I bet you it'll tell me Nashville, Tennessee.
Great.
We were given a little gift bag from some people, and I lost a fucking card.
Yeah.
But it's from a company called Love Heals Thistle Farms.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is a company that's in Nashville, Tennessee, where they make hand lotions and soaps and all this stuff. It's, I think it's, there a lot
There's
of
like
it
a
is
lip balm.
Lip balm. We got lip balm, hand lotion, this amazing, like, I can't stop using it body butter.
Okay, but everyone listen, because there's a thing, and you and I started crying when we read that, like literally crying in the green room when we saw this.
All of the products from Love Heals Thistle Farms are made by women survivors. So these are women who get these jobs because they have been either they just got out of jail or they had
to leave their homes because of domestic violence issues. So they're going to live at this place.
Yep.
And they get this career
and they get a job and they make these amazing, beautiful products. My hands are always dry. There,
yes.
I have a ritual before every show. I put on hand lotion, and if I don't do it, I get a little bit weirded out.
Oh,
every once in a while.
And a mint in your mouth.
A mint in my mouth.
A mint in the mouth and a lotion on your
hand. Hand lotion. This is my new hand lotion.
It's the best
because it's not greasy. And it's curing all of my super dry cuticles.
Dude.
It's amazing.
I'm stealing it.
So it's actually an amazing product that like smells good and really, really works. And also when you buy it, you are supporting these people who are trying to get out of a bad situation.
Who don't just want to go. Yeah. Like they feel like they have a purpose.
Yeah.
God, that's beautiful.
And they're making a product that could be in fucking Sephora.
I like this so much better than the fact that Mimi, who's sitting right here, truly does make me happy, but I don't need to repeat that every fucking episode.
Look, sometimes it's hard.
Listen, that's hard. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that from now on.
That's a good one. Well, also, we get so many, and you guys, we talk when we meet you and you give them to us, we talk to you about it, but we are inundated with amazing, beautiful gifts.
Incredible.
Thoughtful, hilarious, brilliant,
creative, artistic. Like,
it's so fun
and delicious.
It's hard to. We're also traveling, so then we're shoving stuff in our bag. Like I looked around my house because I had actually the card that were that described in detail about
everything
Thistle
gets
Farms. I'm just a sloppy mess. So I'm like, I finally grabbed up this thing where I'm like, well, at least this is in my purse. And I have this information.
Yeah, we're so lucky. People have been so kind to us, and we're so fucking lucky.
Yeah.
Thank you guys.
Yeah. And so be kind to these people. We will post, I will find that thing and then we'll have Stephen post the Thistle Farms because it truly, aside from anything else, it's a great product.
We should have a, we'll talk about it later.
Make some plans on the show.
We should make some plans. I love that. This is so much better.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah. It just takes 5 minutes of thinking. That's all we need to do.
Oh, it's so exhausting.
We're going to get there someday.
We should make a podcast about it.
We should hire a team of secretaries. No offense, Stephen.
But thank you all for listening.
Yes.
You guys are fucking angels.
Thanks for being here.
In the outfield and in the infield. And we appreciate it.
You guys are like ghost baseball players in a cornfield.
We built it.
We look outside.
And you came.
Georgia Rita, she said, we built it. She pushed her boobs together. We built it.
I love grabbing my tits. Thank you guys.
Stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Bye. Elvis? Want a cookie?